take two. We're like 2 minutes into recording, and then like a sensual song came on.
I like that you called it sensual. That's very
funny. It was very sensual. I loved it at first. Honestly, the music came in, and I was.
It faded in nicely too. Like the intro was very like soft off the top, and I was like, oh, is there like background music that we're? And then it like the beat came in, and I was like, no, this is not intentional.
Yeah. Shout out to the studio we're in right now, Hearts God and Beyond. Marco is the owner of this studio, and we're recording in his beautiful space.
It's a really cool space.
Love that. Such a cool space. So great.
I keep nerding out about this space. I sweat like the table, like the wired in table and everything is like.
Yeah.
Oh.
And it's real wood. I think Marco like carved this. I'm seeing him nod. Did you carve this table?
I didn't carve the table.
Oh. Home Depot. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. So, okay. So Marco's saying that the table's from Home Depot. He did not carve it himself, but he drilled all the holes and made.
Hardwired the table.
Yeah. It's very impressive. I love it. Thanks for being here, Matt. Seriously.
Oh, no problem.
I really appreciate it. Yeah. I've always, so as I was saying before, I'll give you another compliment. I've admired you from a distance. Seriously. I've admired you from a distance and the aura that you have given off. And truthfully, I feel like we've only known each other through social media and, mm-hmm. and I mean, we have a lot of mutual friends and stuff too, but, I've been very attracted to the way that you present yourself and what you're about and what you believe in. And I think like, you know, I can speak on behalf of a lot of people that say you're doing a good thing.
Wow, that's
That
was even nicer than the first compliment. So I'm also gonna say thank you very much. I'm learning how to accept compliments, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, no worries. You were saying at the beginning where you know you work as currently as an assistant director in the film industry, and you were saying that you know assistant directors sort of come off. I guess at first, or the idea of the job is that you're supposed to be very tough and you're yelling at people mm-hmm. all day.
I think traditionally, like in sort of like the old world union idea of like what an assistant director is like you're like the traffic controller. So you're like always yelling out what's coming up next and what's going on, and you're sort of keeping the flow of the set moving as quickly as possible. But I've worked with some like old school ADs in the past, and I really kind of don't dig that method of like mm-hmm. shouting all the time and being so assertive and like being really intense. And I've taken this on from other ADs that have mentored me, like Daryl Ferrier and Michelle Delorier, to name a couple.
Yeah.
But they both have sort of like instilled in me, and they also carry this on in their own work of like, you know, kindness and care should always come first, and that we're like the communication department is like the thing that I say to my assistants when I'm bringing on new assistants is like our job is to make sure that the communication on set is always our main priority.
Yeah.
And like if Absolutely. Everybody's communicating well and everybody's well informed,
yeah,
then like I have to use my voice less and less and less. Like if I'm doing my job well, I shouldn't ever have to raise my voice. And if I have to raise my voice on set, then I feel like aside from like if I'm directing 100 background or something and I need to like
address a room or something.
But like generally
but it's not intentionally like mean or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like that's just the nature of the job sometimes.
Yeah.
You have to, you know, you're delegating. You're delegating to a crowd. You're delegating mm-hmm. to your team. So you're gonna have to communicate that way sometimes.
Yeah. But but generally it's like I try to, even if we're like finishing up a scene or something,
yeah,
I'll go around to the keys of the departments and sort of talk to them about like what's coming up next privately, individually, over the course of like the last 10-15 minutes of a scene before we move on.
Right.
So that when we finish the scene, I go, okay, we're moving on to the next scene, and everybody already knows where they're going. Their crew, their teams are already like setting up for the next thing. Everybody's informed, and I'm not shouting at everybody and being like, this needs to go there and that. Like, it's already just happening.
Yeah.
That's always the goal for me.
Yeah, no, 100%. And, you know, myself working as a producer, we're very much and thinking about this, you know, every day, really. We're in the business of relationships. And mm-hmm. so, like, the relationships that you're creating with people is very important. And that's the most, you know, that's the most important thing to me, right? And so when I haven't met that goal and I haven't, you know, done my best in actually, like, you know, fortifying a relationship, or I didn't put that first, I recognize that, mm-hmm. you know? And what I mean by that specifically is working for the product, not the people. Mm-hmm. And that's, you can't work for the product, not the people. It has to be, it has to be both.
I would love to believe that, but it's like, yeah. I have worked on a lot of projects where it feels like the project comes before the people. And I think that's where a lot of my, like, frustrations and the things that I post about and the type of projects I like to work on and the type of projects that I, like, champion and, mm-hmm. and, you know, support are the ones that really do prioritize the people that are making them and, like, care for the people that are making them.
Absolutely. And, yeah, that's what I mean is that, like, obviously sometimes, you know, you're going to be in situations where that isn't always the case. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, we see that a lot with even, like, corporate shoots and corporate mm-hmm. Sort of videos and stuff like that is, like, you know, the people arriving are not necessarily the focus. It's really, you know, what the client wants, what the agency mm-hmm. wants, and that's the goal. But I resonate with that. You know what I mean? I resonate and I really believe that, you know, we can seek those projects if we really manifested mm-hmm. them. You know, like I just got off of a shoot just recently that was like entirely dictated by love and unwavering love and support. Mm-hmm. And you see that in the final film.
Yeah.
You can tell it's made with a lot of genuine love and care. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because from the top down, we fostered an environment of love, mm-hmm. you know, and platonic love, but like we fostered that. And mm-hmm. so, you know, certain posts you've made, for example, about, you know, speaking about certain experiences and, like, you know, your capacity and on projects and everything really resonated with me, because I think that that's an issue. I think that people, you know, are so fixated on the hustle. Mm-hmm. People are so fixated on that end result, even mm-hmm. for themselves. And they're bringing that onto themselves, not from anybody else, only themselves, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's something to talk about, you know? And I think that's something to be really open about, because I feel personally after certain projects that I've done that haven't really, like, you know, that I can tell I didn't do with the people in mind, or maybe that's mm-hmm. what the end result was, I feel sort of guilty of that, you know? Yeah.
I mean, if I like look back on the start of my film career, which hasn't been that long, like I was saying before, like I've done a bunch of other jobs like leading up to film. I only got into film in 2019.
Yeah. Wow.
But I remember my first like year or two, I was really proud of my ability to like never break. Like I was usually in positions where I would be like one of the first people on set and would have to go home last, and I would work these crazy long hours and take a couple of days off between one feature and starting the next one. And like if somebody needed a sixth day and they needed somebody to drive a cube truck in a snowstorm or whatever, I was like, yeah, I'll do it. Like you can count on me. And I always like really prided myself on that, like, that, I mean, that like sacrifice, truthfully, is mm-hmm. that I was willing to like do whatever needed to be done for the production or whatever. And it was like in retrospect, it's like, for what, you know, like why did I sacrifice 2 years of my life? Had no personal life, had no relationships, didn't get to see my family very often. Like that, like, I don't know why I was so like proud of that dedication. And now, like, as I'm like, it's that like hustle culture that you mentioned before, but like now when especially when I'm like training new assistants or bringing people on that maybe I've met as a PA on a set and now they're going to be one of my assistants or something, like I always tell people, like, your personal life, your mental health should always come first. Like, we can make a movie without you. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people like feel like you're sort of bred to believe that that's not the case, that if you don't show up for work, it's the worst thing that you could possibly do, you know, that you're letting everyone down. And it's like, I mean, I've been on sets where the director didn't show up and we still made the movie.
Really?
Yeah. Like the director got sick but we couldn't.
And you had to.
We had to keep moving because of the schedule and the actors were going to be gone. And
somebody,
I think it was like one of the producers like stepped up and directed for like 3 or 4 days.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. No, I love that you say that because it's almost like one of the early lessons I had like in the industry and everything. It was that like everybody on set is replaceable.
Yeah.
For the most part. Everybody, like maybe not some more easily than others, but like in a way, everybody is replaceable. We're not saving lives.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But I think that's also what breeds that like I'll do anything culture.
Yeah.
Is like becoming aware that you're replaceable.
Yeah.
And like wanting to sort of prove yourself as like maybe you'll replace me, but you're not going to get somebody as good as me.
Right.
And that mentality of like, well, yeah, like if I don't show up tomorrow, you'll have somebody else. But like, are they going to like put a tent on their back in -20-degree weather and cross a lake or whatever? Like, probably not. And it's like, yeah, because they're a sane person, you know, like, but that was sort of like the mentality that I had for a long time was like, if whatever, like I would get, like when people would say, oh, we have this really tough feature and it's out in the middle of nowhere and it's a really tight budget. And I would get all these recommendations for these, like people would be like, apparently you're the guy I'm supposed to call because I have this like, but I mean, is that something to be proud of, that I'm the guy that always said yes to the shit shows, you know?
See, like, well, I think that's the thing, right? Is like when you're like people sort of. And that's why for me, it's I try to do as many things as I can, but I also try to focus in on the like those things that I do. I focus on them because I think like when I was starting out, like I was an actor for 10 years and then for about 10 years now I've been doing production.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing a lot of grip and electric work in the beginning, mm-hmm. right? And I was doing production assisting and stuff. Still up until recently, sometimes I'll help out producers or I'll just, you know, friends of mine, and I'll just go and I'll PA for, you know, I don't, my ego isn't that big to not, you know, not do any of those roles. Cause I think, you know, every role on a set is valuable and, you know, and whatnot. But what I will say is like, I found that, you know, the more that I PA'd, for example, the more that I did things not within my, not even my comfort zone, but the more that I did jobs that I really didn't want to do,
mm-hmm.
I would get, you know, people would accustom me into being that guy that, oh, does PAs or does PAing or no, Eric is a driver. Like that's what he does. He drives actors and we can just call him and, you know, use his vehicle and whatnot. And it's only until, and that's what I find is sort of like the beauty of a film sometimes is like you could carve your own path if you really wanted to,
mm-hmm.
right? Like you could go and try to, you know, look at roles that you wanted to do and try to pursue them. It's not always about, you know, like a hierarchy or somebody promoting you. Like sometimes you could go out and carve your own path. And I'm not saying that it's just easy to walk outside and, you know, that's it. Like that's, you've chosen your role and that's the way that it is. But I do think that we have more agency than we think. Mm-hmm. And that starts with us.
Well, I think something like a funny thing, like I have a funny story that you just reminded me of.
Yeah.
And that's maybe about a year ago. Would it have been a year ago? No, probably 2 years ago. I was like primarily ADing.
Yeah.
Occasionally still camera assisting like here and there. But I was like between features and I had a week or something and I wanted to fill a couple of days just to make some extra cash. And I looked on one of those like Facebook, like I need a fixer groups or whatever. And there was one that was just looking for somebody to drive a truck It's pickups one day, shoot day, returns, rates, whatever.
Yeah. It was straightforward and you know.
Yeah, and it was like 1 day shoot, pickups the 1 day, drop offs the next day, those will be half days, but you get 3 days worth of money. And I was like, great, I'll do that.
Yeah.
And I went and did this shoot, and when I like dropped off everything in the truck and like I went up to the producer and I was like, okay, like all I knew about what I'm supposed to do today is just drop the stuff off. Like I don't know what you want me to do for the rest of the day. And she was like, oh, just like, you know, whoever needs help. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, great. And yeah. I ended up like helping set up track for like the dolly. I ended up helping the camera department. I was like one of the people that was whenever somebody needed help, they were like, oh, that guy.
Yeah, you were in every department. You were floating.
Just doing whatever. Yeah. And then at lunchtime, the producer came up to me and she was like, you're not usually just a truck driver, are you? And I was like, no, I've done a lot of different roles. And she was like, so what do you want to do? And I was like, oh, well, like I'm an assistant director. Usually I just picked this job up because like I know I can drive a truck and I just needed some extra cash.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, we really need ADs. Like our production company needs ADs. So like I'll make sure I call you back. Mm-hmm. And that is now one of the production companies that I work for the most often.
Wow.
On the biggest projects I've ever worked on.
And that's because they saw you, for lack of a better word, they saw you hustling in these other departments and they saw you doing your best.
Well, I think, right? But also it was like,
despite the fact that those aren't positions that you wanted to do first and foremost,
right?
You just did your best.
But I think what I'm speaking to is like, I'm no better than a truck driver. Like I can go be a truck driver for a day.
Yeah.
And like, but it's crazy when you just take those little opportunities of like, oh, I'll go drive a truck for 3 days. And then that can turn into this great opportunity, right? Like one of your friends is like, oh, I like my like second grip dropped and I just need somebody that can like carry out of a truck, you know, like,
yeah, exactly.
And you're like, yeah, sure. And then you meet somebody on that set that hires you 6 months later. Oh, like it's
absolutely
the networking opportunities alone. Like it's, I feel like a lot of people get this idea of like, oh, I'm a focus puller now. I'm only going to take focus pulling jobs. It's like,
yeah.
And then maybe they don't work for like a month and a half because nobody calls them for focus pulling jobs. And it's like, you don't have to do that to yourself.
Exactly. And I got this advice from, a friend at the time, and she was like, you know, you shouldn't be PAing. You just shouldn't be doing it. You can't be going out and PAing. You have to focus on directing. You have to focus on, you know, X, Y, and Z. And to a degree, I completely understood that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, that PA gig allowed me to meet this person that allowed me to meet this person that allowed me to go here. Or this job that I worked as a volunteer for, you know, driving, well, it wasn't a truck, but it was, you know, it was a van and I was in charge of it and returning equipment.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up returning equipment, getting into a conversation with the guy that we're dropping off walkie talkies to. Years later, they're one of our partners for the festival that I run.
Right, right.
That wouldn't have happened had I not driven walkies on that specific, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, it's all like, I totally agree with that. It's all connected. And don't be like, you know, obviously there are those, like, there will be those one-off jobs that, you know, you kind of just do and you sort of forget about afterwards and whatever, but that's fine.
Yeah.
Like, you still have to work. You still have to, you know, make money for a living and stuff. But I agree with you. I see what you're saying just about the connectivity of it. And,
yeah. And I mean, we're all like, at the end of the day, we're all filmmakers. We've found these roles that we feel associated to and that we want to do for work. But it's like, we all know how to, you know, how to make the salad. Like, you don't have to be just the guy that peels the carrots. You know what I mean? Like, if you've done it enough, you can help out, you can fill in. And just like, I think being a part of the community like that and understanding how to be flexible and help people is one of my greatest assistants that I hire constantly as an assistant director, she's a camera assistant. She, like, that is her, that's all that she does. And then I'll call her and be like, listen, I really hope you're available, but like, I need your personality. I need your touch. I need you on this because it's going to be crazy.
Yeah.
And I need your kindness to exist in tandem with mine so that it will go well.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's a camera assistant that will probably end up being a DP or a director, and that's like her path.
For sure.
But she's a phenomenal assistant director. Like, just one of the best I've ever had. So
yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. And I love that, you know, I love people that are willing to sort of like jump into other shoes and just mm-hmm. and just help out for the sake of helping out. You know what I mean? And I guess that's what I'm getting into now is ego, because I think unfortunately there is a lot of ego in the industry, and there's a lot of, you know, and I'm sure you've dealt with this on more than one occasion, but it's like you'll meet people that sort of have a certain priority and they won't do anything but that priority, and they won't do things, you know, for other people. And then that leads to maybe you working outside of your capacity and availability and all that. And you've spoken to that quite a bit, right? And you've spoken to sort of your own capacity in the film industry. And that's what, like, you know, drew me to you to begin with, right? It's because, like, I don't think a lot of people are being really honest about what this job really entails,
mm-hmm.
you know? Like, especially people starting out and everything. And I like what you said in the beginning, just about, you know, sacrificing your relationships,
mm-hmm.
your family, your social life. And I've had so many relationships suffer because of the job,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And because of film. Yeah. And it sucks.
Yeah, it's you know? True. I mean, like, I will say, yes, I've also had relationships suffer because of film. I'm not going to go into any specifics, but, like,
yeah,
it's something that has, like, really, it's taken a toll on me, especially in the last, like, 6 months.
Yeah.
But so I kind of hit like a burnout point around this time last year, where I had been, that was like the sort of 2 year point of, I guess, year and a half,
yeah,
year and a half, 2 years of like, I didn't start saying no until this year. So it was like any job, if I had those dates available, even if it was my brother's birthday or if it was, you know, like I was doing a Meta commercial on, like, I think we should, like, might not have been Christmas Eve, but it was like maybe the day before Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
Last year.
Meta as in like what, Facebook?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Cool. It was really crazy how that all kind of like fell into place. But like,
yeah.
I mean, I said yes, cause it was like, oh, we're going to do the Meta rebrand campaign.
Wow.
Like, oh, okay. Yeah. Nice. I'll be a part of that. But yeah. It's like that job, when like we were shooting like a day or two before Christmas, and it was like I thought my year was done, and then I got a call and it was like, hey, I'm trying to fit this last thing in. It's like it's really like down to the wire. They need it now. We can't shoot it in the new year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh well, like, yeah, I'm the yes guy. Like, I will definitely be there. It wasn't a bad shoot. It was a really great shoot. It was a shoot with friends. It was a very ethical shoot. So I don't want to like downplay that or anything.
Yeah.
Like it was sure. One of my like favorite shoots of that year. But I think the year and a half leading up to that, I think I maybe had one, I think I went through my calendar and I had 1 or 2 weeks where I had from a Saturday full week to a Sunday off in a row,
mm-hmm.
like an actual full, like, was that like 9 days, you know?
Yeah.
In a row off. And that only happened to me twice in 2 years.
Wow.
So I was saying yes to everything. It was like finish a feature, maybe pick up a commercial on the week between that feature and the next one, go on to another feature for another 3 to 6 weeks, depending on what it is, like TV show for 2.5 months. Like,
wow.
Just constant, constant, constant. And it was like, started out as a driver, then I was a PA, then I was a camera assistant. I worked as a locations manager. I've done, this year I did an assistant costume designer job. I will not work in the costumes department again because it was very hard. I have
Shout out to costume designers, I have a whole new respect for
the costumes department. And I did it, I did it like for a friend with a friend, and we're so much closer because of it, but like, that is not the role for me. I was really stressed out for that. And it was like 5 or 6 weeks. So it was a long one.
Wow. And that was a feature.
Yeah, that was a feature.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I, this year, like coming out of Christmas into the new year,
yeah,
like this past year, I was like, I had sort of hit like a burnout with ADing.
Yeah.
And I was just like, just really, really worn thin. And like, I mean, there are different weights that different departments carry and different, like different asks of what your job does. And I feel like the ask of being an assistant director is like, you really just give your attention.
Yeah.
Your attention and your mind. And yeah, you just, because you constantly are multitasking and thinking about so many different things that like, when I'm at work, it's like my brain is entirely dedicated to what we're doing.
Yeah.
And to have my brain on so much for so long, I just hit a wall and I was like, I can't say yes to another job. So I went and worked as a driver on Drag Race for 3 months, which was a very fun job and one of the most wonderful yeah. crews I've ever been a part of.
Yeah.
I did a couple of little like mini series things that I was ADing, but it was like with friends and it was very low stakes and it was really comfortable. And
yeah,
it was those like the type of like ethical shoots that I was posting about in my Instagram stories that we talked about with like,
yeah,
when I came on, they would be like, oh, well, this is the budget, this is how we're shooting. And I always ask like, oh, do we have overtime?
Yeah.
And they'll be like, no, there's no, we can't afford overtime. And I go, great. So everyone's going to like probably sign a 12 plus one contract, which is 12 hours worked plus a 1 hour off lunch for anyone who doesn't know what a 12 plus one is. And I'm going to schedule for 10 hour days. And that's always what I lead with is like, if we have no budget for overtime, I'm going to schedule every single day on this shoot as a 10 hour day.
Yeah.
And on the days when stuff goes off the rails, then we have that cushion of an hour or two that we can work with to actually get our day.
Yeah.
But we're not going to add more shots. We're not going to come up with alternate endings or anything because we shot the day in 10 hours and we have two more hours that everybody signed a contract to say that they would be there for a 12-hour day. Like, I'm going to schedule for 10 hours. If we finish in 9, everybody goes home.
Yeah.
And that's like the prioritizing of people that we were talking about is like, if we can like hustle and be coordinated and be organized and really get everything shot in 9 or 10 hours, we should be rewarded for that. We shouldn't be making up, oh, well, we'll just add two more lens coverage, you know, for each of the actors and we'll shoot for another 45 minutes. Why?
Yeah.
You didn't want that yesterday.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's like, oh, but we have the time. It's like, who has the time? Because you're already, like, mm-hmm. you're taking weeks of someone's life. They're yeah. not getting to see their family. They're most likely working like a split by the end of the week, which is like, you know, you start middle of the day and you end at midnight or whatever, or 2 a.m. or something. Like,
yeah.
our lives are so often, through the schedules that I make, are yeah. are like you start at 6 or 7 a.m. on a Monday and you finish at, you know, 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning,
yeah.
and that's like your work week. And trying to like change that and make people see that like that shouldn't be what we just expect our jobs to be like.
Yeah,
I would love to see 8 or 10 hour days be a regular thing, but that's, I mean, that's a lot of people would hear that and be like, that's crazy. Like, it's film, you work all day.
Well, see, that's, well, and that's the thing, right? Is like, and, you know, and I'm not condoning, you know, 12 plus 1 hour days or whatever.
Yeah.
I did a shoot yesterday that had gone for 14, right?
Like yeah.
it's, and the nature of that shoot was very different than a traditional film set, which is why it went longer. And, you know, we were in constant communication with everyone throughout it and people mm-hmm. were fine. But even still, it's like, I it hits me when you say like we're taking hours off away from people's lives, because we are,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I've seen so many posts and, you know, working as a producer, it's like, oh, it starts with the producer. But I would say like, it's sometimes it goes above the producer,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes the producer is given a specific budget or a specific sort of framework from an agency or a client or a studio or whomever, and they have to, and it's their job to work within that framework, mm-hmm. right? That framework could be the fact that we only, you know, maybe we only, we have to shoot in their studio, and we can only shoot in their studio for a certain amount of time. And maybe within that time, you know, we have to get certain shots of the product or certain, right. you know, whatever it is. And we have to schedule based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think sometimes it goes a lot higher than the producer, but even still, the producer is the person in an assistant director in constant, like, is more front-facing for the mm-hmm. production, right? A grip isn't going to go to the executive producer.
Yeah.
Right? A grip is going to go to their gaffer, who's going to go to their AD, who's going to go to their producer. You know, mm-hmm. That's the chain. Yeah. And I think that the more that we can foster a communicative relationship with everybody, you know, top-of-day safety meetings, for example, I've seen that not happen sometimes. Like, yeah. It's important.
Yeah.
You know, and then I go back to, you know, these relationships and everything, like, you know, I find that being someone front facing in film, you're always on, right? It's like at networking events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people will look and they'll go, "Oh, you were at TIFF and you were at all these parties and you were, you know, how fun was that?" It's like, yeah, it's a part of it's fun, but a part of it's also very exhausting.
Yeah.
Part of it's also a lot of work. You know, you're standing in front of someone, you know, five different people, telling each of those people the thing that you're doing and pitching them, hoping mm-hmm. maybe something, someone will bite and maybe they'll nab it, or, you know, whatever it is. Like mm-hmm. it's exhausting. And so, like, when you get out of that zone and you go in front of someone who isn't in that world and you're standing there and, you know, she's looking at you going, "Are you here?" You know?
Yeah.
That hurts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a weird thing. But like this year I really I took a really active, like, sort of
mm-hmm.
tried to really prioritize my personal life. And that was coming off the heels of Drag Race, truthfully. Like Drag Race, the way that they scheduled that show, I mean, we would start it as a driver. I would get to go, like, the transport captain, shout out to Kale.
Yeah.
He like very specifically was like, "No, a driver will never work more than 11 hours in a day. Like right. I just won't do it." And he was like, "So we have a morning shift and we have an evening shift. So if you're on the morning shift, you're starting at 6 a.m. doing the pickups in the morning.
Yeah.
And then by, like, you know, 4, 5 p.m., you get to go home."
Mm.
"And somebody else will start at 11 or whatever and they'll work the rest of the day and then they'll do all the transport home at the end of the night. But because they're doing the late night, the next day they're not going to start until 11 or 12, right?
Right.
So he really, like, he wanted to make sure we were always getting a safe turnaround time,
mm-hmm.
that we were always, like, not being overworked, that, you know, like, really, really prioritizing our safety, but also our lives, right? Like, and when I say lives, I mean, like, personal lives, that we had time away from work and we could get enough sleep and we could maybe see our friends And that comes from, Kale was a driver for many years. And, like, he saw what it was like to do the 16-hour day in a car and be, like, falling asleep at the wheel, you know? Like, I've been that person. I've done runs to Sudbury and back, you know? Like, it's where you're on the way home and it's 4 in the morning and you started at 8 a.m. that day and you're like, you're, like, on your third Red Bull and you're like, "I hope I don't kill everybody in this van," you know, like,
yeah.
But it's just those happen.
I fell asleep at the wheel once.
Was it bad? Like, did you crash it?
I did. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say what production I was on, but I was on a production this summer where it was like a 16 or an 18 hour day. And, I live in Hamilton.
Yeah.
So I had driven into Toronto for the shoot and I had brought one of my assistants from Hamilton with me to be on the shoot with me.
So you were picking them up and bringing them.
Yeah. He also lives in Hamilton. So I picked him up, but we always go like an hour early so we can see what everything's like, you know, get a lay of the land. And before we start our job, maybe grab a breakfast from Kraft or whatever and, like, really comfortably roll into the day and, you know, say hey to people, do the intros all before we're working.
Yeah.
And then the day was this crazy, crazy long day. And then when we were driving home, I woke up at the wheel with him, like, screaming, being like, wake up, wake up, wake up. Like, I had fallen asleep, like, on the 401. And, like, it was terrifying. I, like, wake up and I'm like, the craziest part was, even though he had just been screaming to wake me up and I was, like, white knuckle, I was still, like, kind of fading, just trying to get to the next off ramp.
Yeah.
Because I was so exhausted from the day.
Yeah.
I don't want to, like, blame that on the production. I'm sure if I would have gone to them and been like, listen, I'm too tired to drive home, like, they would have got me a hotel. Like, it's totally would have been fine. But it's just, you know, you, like, you finish the day, you just want to go home.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's, but it was one of those shoots where, like, in pre-production, we were saying, like, this should be a two-day shoot. This really should probably be a two-day shoot. And, like, just because of some of the logistics, like, that wasn't possible.
Yeah.
Talent wasn't available and whatever, yeah. Whatever.
A lot of factors, yeah.
Yeah, but it's like that. I don't think that that story is a rare one. I feel like probably almost everyone I know in film has a similar story.
Yeah. Yeah, so my story, so we were doing an overnight. And I admittedly, I didn't take care of my, and again, I also won't say the production, but I also didn't take care of myself.
Mm-hmm.
Then I didn't drink enough water. I wasn't eating. I wasn't nourishing myself. And I just wanted to go from thing to thing and keep going.
Yeah.
I had dropped off our production designer, or art director, I can't remember, and I dropped her off at her place, and then I was driving, like, I literally just, and on the ride to her place was fine because I had someone in the car, they mm-hmm. were talking and this and that, and I literally had just left her house, was going down this winding road, and I woke up as the car hit the curb, and it was going on the grass, like, bum, 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 and I'm just like, I wake up, oh, And I slam on the brakes, but I had hit a sign, like it was like a no parking sign or something like that. It was like a no parking sign, and the sign had flew and landed. So the top of the sign landed into the grass and was on a 45.
Wow!
Just into the grass like that.
Yeah.
And it had gone past the sidewalk, and it was so early. It was like 6 o'clock or something. Nobody was out. But had someone been, God forbid, had been walking or whatnot, it would have hit him.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm sitting there. I remember specifically the radio still going. And that was so interesting to me because as a kid, I'd gotten a car crash when I was a kid. We didn't have the radio on, though. But my brothers and my mom and I were in a car and we had gotten T-boned. But as I was a kid, I always thought, I had this like really weird sense. I'm like, when a car crashes and the radio's on, does the radio stop working? I don't know why that was ever
a
thought.
I've wondered that, like,
you know,
because I know that it would continue to play, but it's like they should almost design like a kill switch where it's like, if you get in an accident, the radio stops. Cause like,
yeah,
that's, I've seen that in movies before. Like they use it as a plot device or whatever, where it's like, you see a car accident, the car is like flipped over and there's like an old country song playing while like the car's on fire.
Yeah.
But yeah, the radio keeps playing.
And I'm sure if it's like so bad, I'm sure maybe it'll stop. But like the radio is still playing.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there and like the front was all completely like totaled.
Right.
My dad, God bless him, he ended up, so my parents ended up coming because I only had my mom's number memorized, my parents' numbers memorized, right?
Right.
Like we don't have phone books anymore or whatever, right? So mm-hmm. I called, it's the first person I called. Just called my mom and she didn't ask any questions. She's like, where are you? Are you safe? Okay. They came in. As they were coming in, you know, a cop, like a security guard rolls by and he's like, is everything okay? Have you been drinking? And he had a baby in the back. And he let me use his phone because I had also forgotten my phone.
Mm.
And so this is a lot of this is on me, but I forgot my phone in a friend's car and he let me his phone. And that's how I contacted my parents. They came over, you know, my dad removed like the rubber at the front of the car, threw it in the back seat, drove the car home.
Wow.
You know, but yeah, the front of the car was totaled. and it was, and it, and I, and I'll never forget that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget that as the day that, you know, I, on top of, you know, working the overnight, and we didn't even work like a 16 hour day.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, we were, it was probably 12 or maybe 12 and a half or whatever. I mean, still a long day, obviously, but it's just, it's a lesson learned to take care of yourself. It's
well,
a,
I think that's another, time. I think that's another thing is like, there isn't really like there's a culture of like, of, and I've seen this in people that I've been an assistant for. Like I specifically can think of like ADs that I worked for when I was starting out.
Yeah.
That like, that, you know, didn't eat their lunch, and like they were like, oh, I'm too busy, I have to do meetings all through the lunch hour, so I'm not even gonna have my lunch. And
sorry to interject for a second there. Yeah. when you were starting out, you saw that.
Yeah.
That sort of, did you then feel guilty for eating on your lunch?
That
I did,
and I know that a lot of people do, and that's like something that I try to like reinforce with people is like, if, especially if like I'm the first and I have a team of, let's say like 8 ADs on like a big commercial or something.
Yeah.
And I see somebody like scrambling around being like, well, they said they need, and I'm like, it's lunch right now. Like when we go back to work, you can finish whatever you're doing, but whoever told you that you need to do this through your lunch break, just tell them to talk to me. Because, like, that's not okay. We're not going to be frazzled and working through it. Like, you get an hour. Go sit on your phone. Go do, like, just unwind. Like, take the time.
Yeah.
Feed yourself. Have some water. Take a break. Sit down. Because otherwise, we're on all day. And, like,
absolutely.
And I feel like that culture of, like, of taking that break, there's a lot of people that feel guilty about taking a break. It's like... It's like, oh, but I want to be prepared for when we start again. It's like, do the preparation when you start again. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you don't, those breaks are important. And the, like, even with water and hydration and things, like, whenever I'm training new PAs and stuff, I'm like, the best thing that you can do if you have nothing to do is just take a grocery bag, fill it with bottles of water, walk around to everybody on set and offer them a water. Because a lot of people are working so much, they don't even think about...
They don't even think about it, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, well, I have 50 things to do. I, like, it's the last thing on your mind.
Yeah.
And it can be really beneficial for someone new to be that person that people think of as the person who's, like, nurturing them.
Yeah.
In a kind of weird, like, psychological way. Like, if you're the person that's always coming around being like, hey, did you remember to have a water or whatever? Like, the next time that somebody's like, oh, I need to rely on someone... You're a reliable person by default, you know? Like, so those are things that I try to tell people that are starting out is, like, offer people waters, ask people if they need any help, and also just, like, check in on people. Like, how's your day going?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a weird question to ask people. A lot of people are, like, put off by that. If you're just like, hey, how's your day going? Like, especially as an AD, if I ask, like, a key grip, like, if I go up to them and I'm like, hey, how's your day going? They're like, well, we're working on that. And I'm like, no, I'm not asking about,
I'm not
work.
Asking like, about time.
Yeah.
I'm asking about you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people are just so not used to that, used to being cared for.
I was on hold with Fido. She comes on and I'm like, how's your day going? She's like, fine. Why did you call? Like,
yeah.
you know, I 100%. I wholeheartedly believe that, I mean, if we're talking psychologically, I think that our, you know, in the day to day, we're so wrapped up in how we're executing the day, what mm-hmm. we're doing from point A to point B. I gotta go pick this up and drop this off. But before I pick this up, I gotta do this. And then after I pick it up, I gotta do this. Then I gotta drop it off by this time. It's all, mm-hmm. it's all scheduled. And when that one person sort of comes in and just goes like, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Or I've been asked, how's your heart?
Yeah. Those are always good ones. I like things
you know?
Like that. Yeah.
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 And I even like, even now, like even when I'm firsting, I've been on shoots where I see like a frazzled producer and I'm like, did you get lunch?
Yeah.
And they'll be like, well, I got it. I'm like, just answer the question. Like if you didn't, like, I'm not doing anything right now. I'll go get your lunch for you.
Yeah.
And it's like, you see people's faces like, oh my God, would you like, it's like, yeah, of course. Like if you're so extended that you can't even go get your own lunch, I would love to take that off your plate, no pun intended, but like I would.
Yeah, that's great.
But it's just like I wish that that kind of like take a step back, breathe a little.
Yeah.
And just like you were saying before, like we're not saving lives. Like it's crazy. It's really crazy the lengths that people just inherently feel they need to go to. And you see people running. It's like they hear something on the walkie and they're running across a field to go get like a bounce or something. And it's like, it's not that serious, dude.
Do you know? Like, yeah. And I think, and you know, and I've worked with, you know, other producers before in projects and other, whether it be 80s, like people in positions of leadership, and I can tell that they haven't taken that time for themselves, mm-hmm. right? They're running themselves to the ground.
Yeah.
And I find it guilty. I find myself feeling guilty or feelings of guilt when I see other people I'm working with that I feel like are working harder than me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's this fucked up sort of perception where it's like, oh, well, you know, they're working through lunch. Maybe I should be doing that. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should be taking that call or on that call or whatever it is, you know? And
on that guilt thing. I've recently started doing a couple of like directing projects. Oh. And one of the biggest things that I'm dealing with like mentally when I am directing is like that I'm not doing the thing.
Yeah.
That it's like I explain what I want and then a bunch of other people go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just stay there, you know, like that's weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a really weird feeling that I'm like,
yeah,
I'm really like battling with on these like few directing projects that I've started taking. And it's like,
yeah.
And it's also a weird thing because like I did a music video for a friend, and then I was at her like her EP release show, because the music video came out with her EP as like a part of the like the release package or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And I was at the release show and she was like introducing me to people as like, oh, this is the guy that directed my music video.
Yeah.
And like these people were being like, oh my God, it was such a great video. You did such a great job. Like whatever, whatever. And I was like, I didn't do like my friends that I hired to be the DP and the art director and the sound, like they did the work.
Mm-hmm.
I just was like, I want it to look like this. And my friend who's a phenomenal DP was like, oh yeah. All. And he lights it all and sets it all up. And then I literally just look at a monitor and I go, can we maybe like dial this? And he goes and changes it all. And like, those are the people that made the video.
Yeah.
And it's this really weird guilt that I'm feeling now where it's like, I'm receiving praise and I do feel really proud of the projects. Like I think they're great, but I think that they're great because of the people that I worked with. I don't feel like I'm the turnkey in this, you know, like,
yeah. I mean, I listen, and being a director myself, like I, you know, the one of the shorts I directed called Pressure Play, that Michelle actually was one of the ADs on.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Shout out to Michelle Deloria. She's great. She's taught me so much. We had on one day, we had over 100 people on set.
Mm-hmm.
We had like 60 background actors, 30 crew members. Then we had like 15 basketball players and then another 15 people like on the sidelines, like on the benches.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time I'm going around and like I see our third AD like hyping up the crowd. You know, the background actors like in the gym watching this game is this big game sequence. And then I see, you know, my cinematographer talking to all of his heads of department. I see my actors rehearsing. I see everything happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, is this me?
Yeah.
Where do I fit in this room? But then I think it comes down to what we're talking about, leadership, right? Because even you as a director, I haven't been on one of your sets, but I can imagine that, you know, this idea is stemming from you. You found the people to make it happen. But if there is ever a creative ask, you're the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a lot of responsibility. It's a creator's responsibility in a way to go ahead and say, okay, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to accept the vision. I'm going to accept what's wrong with the vision. I'm going to accept what's right with it. And I'm going to accept how it's executed.
Well, that's actually a funny thing. So the day that we were shooting the video that I was talking about,
yeah,
we were supposed to shoot 3 songs that day. And it was a like live off the floor kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
So we... It I had
performance, more performance. Yeah, okay,
it was
okay.
Performance videos.
Cool.
And I had this concept of it would go, one song would have this look, and then the next song would have a different look, and then the last song would have a final look. And they were all sort of like sunlight dependent. So the first song was like, it's the sun's kind of setting and we have these like beautiful beams coming through the windows.
Yeah.
And then the next one, I wanted it to be kind of like dusky, a little like sort of blue hour in the room. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to be this big one-er where we do this like big slow push in to like a close up on her face over the course of like 2 minutes into the song. And then we pull back out. And as we pull back out, there would be a hidden cut. And as we pull back out, the whole room's changed around her as we like pull back out.
Yeah.
And then the last song was to be performed in the room now that has been changed in the,
They all continue through each other. Oh wow.
Yeah. And the second song,
yeah,
we tried the one-er 3 times and it wasn't working. We were losing the light. We tried to set up lights to like make it work. And I was just like, let's just do the next song.
Huh.
And like the DP looked at me, he's like, You wanna like just cut one of the songs? I was like, yeah, it's not working. So like let's make the first video and the last video, let's make them as good as they can be. And let's just get rid of that middle video because it's not.
And why was that? What was the?
It was like we were making all these compromises that I was like, it's not, the compromises aren't benefiting the work. You know, like we're really just shooting this because we said we'd shoot it. And like, I would rather have the 2 really good videos instead of this like original arcing 3-piece thing that I wanted. I would rather have 2 really good videos than make these compromises that are going to take a bunch of time and then it's going to cannibalize the rest of the day for the last video and probably affect the last video. And like, why don't we just make 2 really good videos instead of this one big? And like the artist was like, I mean, I'm okay with that if you're okay with it. And I was like, I'm totally okay with it. Like, it's just what I wanted isn't working. And now it's like, we can just do another video for this song. We'll do it another day.
Yeah.
And she was like, okay, great. And my friends that were my crew were like, are you sure, man? I was like, yeah, we're good. But it's like, nice. I think that ability to like adapt.
Yeah.
Yeah. To just accept that something isn't working.
Yeah.
But that weight does fall on you as the director where you're like, you're the person that says, yeah, just cut it. We're never going to use this scene. We're never going to.
Yeah.
This video isn't going to work the way I wanted it to.
And I think great directors can also do that within their personal relationships.
Oh, I want to
outside of
elaborate film. On that.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Because and I'm and it's so interesting. Now I'm making this connection in speaking with you because I think growing up, I haven't been honest with myself in some of the relationships, but not like platonic and romantic. It's like relationships in any sort, even working relationships. I'm not always honest about how that relationship serves me because I care more about making it work.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like similar to the way that, you know, with this music video and you were, you know, you're trying to make it work. You're trying to, you know, obviously in a very different way. Like, I don't know what exactly the limitations you had were, but let's imagine, you know, maybe one of the locations you're trying to wrap around in a wonder, but there's like a specific wall there that's going to be hard to get around and light and whatever the case is.
Sure.
But you're trying over and over again to make it work. And in personal relationships, it's like I had a really, really strong friendship that I think I've lost with somebody. And it got to a point where we weren't speaking to each other the way that friends should speak to each other anymore. Mm-hmm. It wasn't uplifting and motivational anymore. It was a lot meaner, you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't, and so I think that, you know, maybe parts of it, there were maybe jealousies involved. Maybe there were some ego things. I don't know, but my point is like understanding how far we're willing to go to accept when a relationship has served us and when it doesn't anymore,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think as a director in film, you have to make those decisions all the time
mm-hmm.
about what in the story no longer serves the overall story. Writing's a big thing, and we'll get into that in a sec, but like, for me, it's like writing, you know, I'm writing a feature right now and it's like, oh, well, all of these things happen to me, so they all have to be
right
in the film. And I'm not looking at it as an audience member. I'm looking at it as like my life story, like in my life, all of these specific events happen. Yeah. So they have to be in the film.
Yeah.
When realistically it's like, well, when you're watching it as an audience, it doesn't really connect.
Well, it's funny that you actually, and as the segue into writing, but like I also am a writer.
Yeah.
And, I like through the pandemic, I wrote a book, and I remember very specifically, I like sent
Greenbelt Summer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for that little shout out. but yeah, I sent the first draft to one of my best friends, and, I had been through like a breakup, a very amicable breakup. It was like right before the pandemic started.
Yeah.
We had been together for like 3.5 years, and we decided to part ways, and we're still very close friends to this day.
Yeah.
But when I sent one of my best friends the first draft of my book, she was like, I have a very personal question to ask you. And I was like, yeah, of course. What's up? And she was like, are you using this book to try to get your ex back? And I was like, no, not at all. And she was like, that's how it reads. And I was like, that's really great information. I need to keep writing. And that, like,
wow,
that draft, I would say only maybe 60% of it made the final draft. Like, I cut a bunch of stuff out that,
because did you realize that when she was right?
Well, when I went back and I read through it and I tried to have like a sort of pull myself back and not just,
yeah,
am I including, because originally it was like I was just including all the things I had written over the past year.
Yeah.
And some of the earlier stuff I was writing while I was in the middle of the breakup.
Yeah.
And I sort of realized like the tone of the book should be a lot more about like nature and freedom and like experiencing the summer, because that's like what the book is about. It's like the sort of the, I think I described it as like a love letter to Southern Ontario summers, because they're like so short and we all like really try to make the most of it.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be more about that and less about like romance or heartbreak or these kinds of things. So I cut a lot of the, like the, there are still a lot of like love poems and stuff in the book, but like I cut a lot of the like more personal ones that I was writing at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I think the book is much stronger because of it. But without that like insight of like,
mm-hmm.
is this the story that you're trying to tell?
Yeah, that's a very mature realization, because I'm doing the same thing right now. Like I've been writing this feature for about 5 years. I finally finished the first draft in July on a plane.
Wow.
And it was one of the, this has been what, in general, I mean, I've had what I find to be one of the most emotional years I've ever had for several reasons, and this being one of them. And I finished the first draft, but then I realized as I was, because I'd been writing it for 5 years, I realized, like, you know, in rereading it now, I'm about halfway through and doing the second draft. I noticed like at what point in my life I was at writing all these things, and I'm like, oh, I wrote that because I was upset about, okay, yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, I get it, I recognize it, but I'm putting it away, I'm digesting it, and I'm setting it free, you know. And I think that's a really mature realization, because like all the stuff that I write is very personal.
Yeah,
same. You know, my protagonists are all fictional versions, for the most part, are fictional versions of myself,
right.
And I do narrative, and so like when you have dialogue come in and you know, like I'm writing this one short called Kira right now that I've also been writing for a few years, but it's gotten stronger with every draft because it's a lot more mature.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the first draft was like, yelling about this relationship ending and possibly even using it to get her back. I don't know, some twisted story about that. But moving forward and years later, it's like, okay, no, this is speaking not on a more broad level. It's still very specific, but it's also not specific to my emotions,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, so I applaud you for doing that because it's not hard. It's not easy.
Well, I think that's like that's the writing, right? Like the getting it all out is, it's like flashy journaling, really. Like the first draft is like, it's, you're just showing somebody your journal. And then you kind of have to go back through it and be like, okay, which parts of my journal die in my closet and which parts of my journal do I put on a wall for people to look at? What kind of story am I trying to tell? And, which days of the journal were just boring? Which days of the journal were like, I was just really in my feelings and it's just a little too self-indulgent. Maybe we should, we should leave that one.
Yeah.
But it's like the writing process for me is the editing process. Like I think it's a Hemingway quote is, write drunk, edit sober, I believe is a Hemingway quote.
Yeah.
But,
I saw that in a tweet. Someone tweeted that.
I'm sure. it was probably me.
She didn't quote Hemingway though, but she should have.
Yeah. I've definitely done a lot of that. I find like there's nights where maybe I've been at a bar for a couple hours and I'm walking home and I just, this thing hits me and I'm writing on my phone for sitting in my apartment before bed for like an hour.
Yeah.
And then I wake up the next morning and I go through it and it may be two pages worth of stuff. And at the end of it, it's a paragraph because I'm like, there was some good stuff in there, but it got a little repetitive and this was, but it's like the editing process is what really makes it really beautiful. And there was actually a piece that I wrote recently that I would say is probably my favorite thing that I've written. And it's about these two birds chasing each other on my roof, and I can hear them running around on my roof. I'm pretty proud of the piece, but I was like showing it to one of my friends who's like a writer friend, and he finishes reading it and he's like, that was really beautiful. And I was like, they were squirrels. And he was like, what? And I was like, it was squirrels. It wasn't birds, they were squirrels, but I just figured it would be prettier if they were birds. And he was like, yeah, it definitely wouldn't have been the same if it was squirrels. But it really happened in my life where I like heard these squirrels on the roof and I started thinking these things and I started writing this thing. And then when I went back through and I looked at it all, I was like, this would be better if they were birds.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's like in those edits that you really find what you're trying to say, you know, mm-hmm. like where you take the artistic license to change it and make it into something that carries the intention that you have more than just the telling of the thing that happened to you.
No, for sure. And I think that's sort of the challenge with, embedding personal experiences into our work is because like, how true do we want to be to what actually happened?
Yeah.
But then the honesty we have to have with ourselves with fictionalizing what we've also experienced, because, mm-hmm. There's no way that, every single little detail in a story that happened in real life could always be translated on screen. Sometimes, yes. Sometimes, like, we've seen biopics, we've seen, historical accounts and everything, of course. But I think in fiction and working with characters and narrative and everything, there is a line between what we've experienced and what we want the audience to experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think going between both is very interesting.
Have you seen that? There's that movie that was made during the pandemic that's Zendaya and John David Washington.
Malcolm and Marie.
Yeah, Malcolm and Marie. That's like, that movie is about that, right? Like it's their relationship and he's a writer and they went to the premiere of his film.
Yeah.
And he like wrote and directed the film. And then the rest of the movie is them when they get home from the premiere.
Yes.
Like it all exists in their house.
Yeah.
But it's them fighting about how she was like, you wrote that movie about me and then you never even thanked me in your speech. That's like the start of the fight. But then it's like as the fight progresses through the night, it's like there's parts where he's like, it's actually a collection of memories from six different girlfriends, and like,
yeah,
and it's you're actually not the it's not your
it's
story.
Not, it's you're not the centerpiece.
Yeah, and yeah. It's like, but there's this really interesting tension where they, I mean, they're truthfully, they're very cruel to each other in that fight. It's like, yeah. It was a really like, I like felt that there movie in my gut. I was like,
yeah.
I was like, you don't,
and
you
it got
never...
a lot of, it got a lot of criticism too, but I found when I was watching it, I was very engaged.
Yeah.
Throughout the whole thing. I mean, it's, you know, Zendaya and John David Washington are carrying it, right?
Yeah.
Like they are, you know, it's their performances or nothing.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it's a bar. It exists in the house. Like,
exactly.
They never go anywhere else. Like,
exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
But that film, so there's two things I want to say about that film. One, I watched that while I read the script. So I found the script online and I downloaded it and I read the script while I watched the movie.
Oh, wow.
And there were times where, like, because there's a lot of, like, monologuing in that script where it's, like, a whole page.
Yeah.
And there's times where one of them will go completely off script,
yeah,
for like a page.
Yeah.
And it's like you see little pieces pulled from it, but it's,
oh, wow,
like what's on the page is not like what's happening on screen. Yeah.
Wow.
And then there's,
okay,
other times where the whole, it's almost word for word the whole page and you're like, oh my God, like this is a masterclass. Like,
wow.
But it was really interesting to see where they chose to take their liberties and where they chose to really stick to the script.
Yeah.
But another thing I wanted to talk about, and I'm this is going to bring us back to the like ethical producing thing. That film is my, from what I've read online, is my like North Star for how to produce a film, because they had a tiny little crew. They had it wasn't an ambitious script in the sense of like special effects or car chases or any, it was, mm-hmm, it was a dialogue piece, right?
Yeah.
But they made it during the pandemic, so they all lived together.
Yeah.
And they made it in this house. They rented out this house, and they made it over a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But they paid everybody their day rates, but then they gave everyone on the crew back-end points. So everybody got a percentage of when that movie sold. And I don't remember what the numbers were, but,
oh,
I remember,
wow,
reading that, like...
Everybody on that crew.
Everybody
like
on
every,
that crew. There,
oh,
was, like,
wow,
like 40 or 50 people that made that movie. And it was like, I think like when they sold it to Netflix, it was like the, like, I think it was, I may be misremembering, but I think Zendaya was like, I want to give everybody back end points. Like, I think it was somebody that was like a key person.
And she was one of the producers on that film,
yeah,
too, right?
And
yeah.
I think it was, I don't know if it was her, if it was somebody else that was higher up. They were like, we're going to give everybody back end points. And it's because,
yeah,
this is like a passion project and we're making it with our friends. Because I think most of the crew were keys from, what's that show?
Is that Euphoria?
Euphoria.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Euphoria got shut down because of the pandemic. And
right.
I think, like, the creative group that were all living it, like, they were all there to make the show.
Right.
And they were like, well, we still want to make something. Let's just take a few of us and go make this thing. And
right. I remember this now.
Right.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But I read,
yeah,
that it was something like the Focus Puller made, like, $100,000 when they sold the movie, because they sold the movie to Netflix for, like, so much money that,
yeah,
even the Focus Puller made $100,000. I don't know if that's,
wow,
maybe it was $10,000.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I remember
I remember hearing about this now that you're jogging my memory. That's, yeah. And I think, like, I mean, the lesson learned here is make a movie with your friends and sell it.
I think that's an interesting, like,
no, it is
a business model. And I know, yeah, that there's other indie filmmakers that have done this business model for,
yeah,
you know, decades. Like, they're not the people that came up with this. I know, like, the Duplass, mm-hmm, brothers do it. And what's his name? The guy that did Easy. That's really going to bother me. I feel really bad because he's one of my favorite creators.
I'll look it up.
Okay. But I know that he like made indie films with his friends in Chicago for years and years and years. And they would all, like, if they sold a movie, everybody would get a piece.
Joe Swanberg.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, they both, the Duplass brothers and Joe Swanberg, both have really good, I think it was both South by Southwest talks that, mm-hmm, are about like producing and how to produce at an indie level, and,
yeah,
everybody makes the same rate, and,
yeah,
it, like, really interesting talks if anyone wants to look those up. But yeah, I think that that's an interesting model going forward, because, like, traditionally you make a movie that sells for, you know, tens of millions of dollars,
yeah,
and 9 of those million go to the executive producers that live in Hollywood, and,
yeah,
you know, like,
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's fucked up how it's divided, and I think, you know, coming back to like ethical producing and like, you know, treating your crew members fairly and everything is that like, unfortunately, I guess, you know, working in Hollywood or the way that it is, is there is that hierarchical model.
Yeah.
But as much as we can, actually diffuse that, that's our key, mm-hmm. right? And on these productions where we have that control, like, you know, we're in leadership, you and I are in leadership positions. We can dictate how the day goes.
Yeah.
You know, we come on and, you know, people are working at 12 plus, you know, over 12 hour day. Oh no, we're not getting second subs because we'd rather save money and put that towards another line item in the budget, this and that, right? But ultimately, these are the people that are showing up for you.
Yeah.
You invest that back in the people, what are they giving back to you? You know, and sometimes obviously you might have that oddball or whatever that still isn't happy for whatever reason, and that's to be expected. But for the most part, putting that energy back into those people and understanding, like, these are the people that are sticking up for us. These are the people that are showing up every day.
Mm-hmm.
What do you get back?
Yeah. I mean, I just AD'd / produced a music video a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And because of our time constraints, we had to be out of the location by 5 p.m.
Right.
And I was like, oh, we're gonna start at 8. And I remember when I said we're starting at 8 in the meeting, it was like, oh, that's only like a 9-hour day? Was that a 9-hour day with lunch? It's like, we're only going to work for it. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I looked at the shot list. I know what we're doing. And We only need an 8-hour day.
Yeah.
And everybody was like, yeah, I think we can, like, the DP was on board and we've worked together before. And the director was like, yeah, I think we can get what we need. And we finished early. We were done by like 4.
Wow.
And it was because we set the schedule and I was like really making sure we were keeping on pace with the schedule in the morning so that when we got into the afternoon, and it got to a point where, like, even in the afternoon, like, knowing we were going to be at like around 2:30, we're down to like our last 3 or 4 shots. And I was like, okay, like, we have all these extras. They've been here for like a half hour. You kind of like, they need to feel like they were a part of it. So let's make a couple of extra shots here so that we're not bringing people all the way in for like, oh, with 20 minutes of shooting. Okay, everybody can go home. Like, let's at least give them like an hour so they feel like they were on a movie set.
Yeah.
But it's like at the end of the day, I remember when we were getting close, like I think it was the gaffer was like, hey, when do you think we're going to get out of here? I was like, oh, we'll probably be done like a half hour. And he was like, what? And I was like, yeah, I mean, like, we scheduled till like 5, but things are going well. So we'll probably start cleaning out like around like 3:30, 4 o'clock. And he was like, that's crazy. And I was like, yeah, I mean, we don't need to, but that like, and I've seen the edit of the video. It looks great. It's a fantastic video. Like, we don't need to
I wonder for how many of the shots people get by extending the day, how many of those shots end up making the final cut?
I guarantee very few. Like, that's the crazy part. It's like, you, even like, I just went to a TIFF premiere for a movie I worked on last year, and I loved the edit. The movie turned out phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I remember at the end of the movie, a bunch of us, like, we all had like an after party for like all the people that were on the crew or whatever.
Yeah.
And so many people were like, we spent like 2 days in that house and none of it got into the movie. You know, like, they just completely chopped like a whole section. And then like, but like, that happens, you know, and it's so funny to see, you know, maybe there was a day where you did a half day and the whole scene's in there and it takes up like 5 minutes of the, but then there's another day where you shot for 3 days at this place and it's like, it didn't really serve the story and it just gets chucked, right?
No, that's hilarious. I did a short last year and we set our sights on having a pickup day because we wanted two characters, you know, meeting, and the director wanted two characters meeting in the future. We were really adamant about getting this. We were pushing for it and we even spent, you know, we spent more money for the day, called back crew and all that. We ended up cutting it.
Yeah.
I hustled a priest, like, got him to give us a church, use the church, all good. And we cut it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
But exactly. Yeah. And I'm not like looking back on it with any, you know, like, it's fine. Like, it is what it is. And we did like the idea at the time and everything, but, you know, the director ultimately decided to cut it and, you know, she has all the power to do that. But it's just interesting. It's interesting. And I think like, and maybe that comes into the conversation of when we have to be honest with ourselves about what we have and the characters we're writing and what works and what doesn't work, mm-hmm. and fitting everything in and killing your darlings, you know? Because that could have an effect on people's capacity.
Yeah. I think also like the, like something that I don't see as often as I think I should, yeah. is people prioritizing the like the actor's well-being.
Right.
And I've seen that on a bunch of movies where it's like, yeah. we're just doing take after take after take of like someone crying over their dead husband or whatever. And it's like, this is taking a toll on this person.
Yeah.
Like I was on a movie where we had an actor have like a full breakdown in the middle of a scene. She was supposed to be crying. She was crying. And then she started like wailing. Like she was, and everybody saw it shift. And it was like, okay, like cut the cameras, like this is, and we had been telling the director, like, we can't keep doing these takes. Like this is really like taking a toll on her.
Yeah.
Cause we could see it.
Yeah.
And she snapped and she was she was sitting with the medic for a while. We sent her home for the rest of the day. Like it was really rough.
Wow.
But it's like,
wow.
sometimes we get so caught up in like what we want and like maybe a director is not seeing the performance that they want. So they're like, we got to do it again. And
yeah.
I try like, let's do a camera rehearsal, make sure that all of the things we're supposed to hit with the crew is completely dialed. So before she sheds a single tear, we know we're going to use that first take. If she nails the performance, we're going to use the first take. We're not going to be like, oh, I kind of wish it was on a 50. You know, like,
right.
it's that's not going to happen after someone has a breakdown, right?
Yeah.
Like, I just did a short where it was supposed to be somebody crying about their husband passing away. And we did probably 6 to 10 camera rehearsals before, just walking through the room because it was supposed to be a oneer.
Mm-hmm.
And she, like, finds her husband and he's passed away.
Yeah.
And we did all these camera rehearsals over and over again. And I said to the actor, I was like, don't cry in the camera rehearsals. Don't give us the performance. Just walk through, hit your marks. We'll make sure that we get all our focus marks. And we just did it over and over and over again until like the director and the actors were all happy. And then I think we did maybe 3 takes and it was like, oh yeah, we could use any of those 3. Great. And that,
yeah,
done with the day.
Yeah. And that's what's so interesting about being a director too, is understanding how to, knowing when you have it,
yeah.
knowing when you have the performance, but also being able to communicate with your actor ahead of time and communicate, because a scene like that is the actor, you know, having a freak out, it's very emotional for them. It could also be triggering for people watching.
Yeah.
You know, and understanding, like, I made a movie. I'm a survivor of sexual assault from when I was younger. I made a short about it. And the day that we filmed the assault scene, right, the character who is, like, I mentioned, the protagonist, a fictional, you know, version of myself, is sitting there and is being assaulted. And filming that was obviously, you know, obviously came with its trauma for me, but like,
sure.
understanding everybody watching that.
Yeah.
We all know we're making a movie, but in yeah. that moment,
yeah,
you know, who knows? And so our main priority was understanding crew safety, understanding actor safety, understanding the environment that we're in, allowing people to leave if they needed to,
mm-hmm.
whatever they had to do to take care of themselves,
mm-hmm.
right? But understanding that, like, the success of your project is imperative on who is around you. And how they're doing,
mm-hmm.
and what they're bringing to the table, because ultimately, shaving a few dollars here and there can make sense and work in the moment. But in the future, that project, are we remembering the $100 we saved on that day, or are we remembering a crew member walking out,
mm-hmm.
or a crew member getting to an accident?
Yeah,
almost getting to an accident in your case.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I mean that's
yeah.
what it is. It's like
we've come full circle.
I want to make the art just as much as anybody else, but like,
yeah.
but we have to recognize that the people that are making the art are people.
Absolutely.
And that we need to like take care of each other. Absolutely. Just in general, not even in film, but just in the world, right? Like,
absolutely. And listen, man, I recognize my blind spots. I recognize where I could have done better, and sometimes I suffer for it.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think it's important to recognize where we're at, where we can go, how we can learn from where we can go.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And move forward.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Especially with things like hustle culture or...
Yeah.
You know, like letting those, like, set and setting better examples as leaders that, like,
yeah,
you know, this is not our cross to die on, you know, like, this absolutely. Is we're making entertainment.
Absolutely. Greenbelt yeah. Summer. Where can we find it?
It's on Amazon.
There you go.
Yeah. And also if you ever run into me, I usually keep a couple of copies in my car. So. Yeah.
Amen. There you go. Well, it's out now, and you know, I hope that people read it. I hope that people grab it and people read it. And your process and your way of thinking is something that I haven't seen even in people working in film like twice, three times as long as you. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think you've made mature realizations having worked in the film industry. You only said for only even a few years, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And that's incredible, man. And I mean, I'm not a veteran. Who am I? I've only been in what, I guess, in production for 10 years, but even still, it's like, I'm still coming to that. Yeah. I'm understanding that now, you know, mm-hmm. and growing up and everything. How are you making this year your year?
This year is my friends decided this at the beginning of the year, that this year is my year that I step into directing. I had friends for a while being like, and it's actually weird. I would be on sets where, as an AD, I would be helping a director work through something, and they'd be like, "Oh, what projects are you directing?"
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, "Oh, I'm not." And they're like, "But you're a director, though." And I'm like, "No." And they're like, "But you want to be?" And I'm like,
"Why do you think he said that?"
This happened to me a bunch of times.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
not
yeah.
just one person. Okay. Like, this yeah. was like a reoccurring thing, and
yeah.
and over the last couple of years. And then there was around the fall of last year, I was away on a project with some people, and somebody like asked, they were like, "Well, you have a book, like you're a writer, and you work in film all the time. Like, are you writing anything?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, I've written." And they're like, "So when are you making it?" And I was like, "Oh, I just write things and put them away." And they're like, "Well, when are we making it?"
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, I don't know." And literally everybody that was sitting at the, like, at this hangout after set one day, like, we were all at a hotel, like, just hanging out, having beers or whatever. They were all like, "Oh, yeah, just say a day. We'll all be there." And I was like, "Wow, that's so nice." But it was like,
yeah.
they knew me enough that they trusted whatever I wanted to do. And those are the people that are now helping me on these music videos that I'm making. And
yeah.
we have a short that we're doing in at the end of the month. And
yeah. That you're so, directing.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
So this, and I have like a mini series that I've been writing for the last like year or two that mm-hmm. hopefully I had some talks with like some funding bodies to try and get it going. And, yeah. but yeah. I kind of might want to make it myself because
mm-hmm.
there were notes that I was getting back that I was like, "Oh, those aren't really compromises that I'm willing to."
Yeah. And it's important to be honest with yourself about that as well, I find, because, like, you know, when you're making something, especially if it's very personal to you, but also just your art in general, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to have opinions. And I want to touch on one last thing. It was something I wanted to share with you. And it is a conversation that I heard that sort of prompted me to chat with you was a conversation that Andrew Garfield and Marc Maron had on a podcast, on his podcast, on Maron's podcast recently. Because you and I, even in this short amount of time, I've spoken about, you know, relationships, whether, you know, platonic or romantic or working or whatnot, those that start and those that end. And I think, you know, and I've been in my own sort of healing journey over the last, you know, I mean, the better part of this year, is really understanding how to sit in emptiness and how to sit in that emptiness of whatever it may be, right? Of a, you know, a lover that you used to have that, let's say, used to sit across from you in your apartment, or maybe, you know, a friend that you used to drive to work every day used to sit in the front seat of your car. You look at that empty seat,
mm-hmm.
whether it be in your car, in your house, or whatever it is, and you're learning to accept that emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
And you're learning to accept that quiet and that silence,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's just something that I've been learning to cope with this year. And I think it was an incredible conversation, and you should check it out. But I think it applies here as well.
Yeah. I feel like this feels like very Truman Show-y, because the last like 3 weeks for me have been like really addressing exactly what you just described, which is a very funny thing for you to bring up. but from the TIFF premiere, I got COVID. Because the TIFF premiere was thousands of people in the Scotiabank Theater. Like they were, it was, there's like six premieres going on at once. There's lineups at the door.
It's
it was insanity.
Yeah.
had not had COVID yet. This was my first time having COVID.
Oh, wow.
But, earlier this year went through like a bit of a heartbreak situation and through the summer was sort of like trying to reconcile that. And one of the things that really was hard for me was there were like, it felt like every part of my apartment belonged to that other person. So it was like, whenever I would be home, I would like look at my couch and be like, oh, that's where they used to sit when we'd watch movies together. Or like there was a point where like I didn't like sleeping in my own bed, so I would sleep on my couch because I felt weird sleeping in my own bed when they weren't there. And when like what I ended up doing to sort of not address that was like I was going out all the time. Like I would, after work, I would go hang out with my friends, or I would like, I just would avoid being at home as much as I could. If even like when I would take my dog for a walk, it'd be these big long walks because I would just rather be outside than be at home. And when
we lived together, or did she, was she,
was just over visit? Often.
Yeah. Okay.
And, so then I got COVID from TIFF and I had to quarantine and I had to stay home for 2 weeks. Yeah. Right. And at first I was like, it was really hard to just be in the space and have everything remind me of this person. And then after a few days, it was like the space sort of started feeling like mine again. And then I sort of was doing a lot of reflecting and realized those patterns of like, oh, I was going out so often because I didn't want to address how I felt about my apartment. And then I cleaned my whole apartment and I rearranged things and I tried to fix it all up so it felt nice and new and clean. And and in the wake of that 2 weeks of forced self-reflection, now I'm like, you know, trying to spend time with close friends, and I'm trying to, spend more time at home, less time going out. I just like doing the opposite of what I was doing, like really trying to like claim my own space again. And to like, just to live in it, because before, like I've lived in that apartment alone for like the last 2 or 3 years, right. And it was very comfortably my space.
Yeah.
And then I welcomed this person into my space and it became theirs in my head. And now it's like trying to just make it feel like my space again.
I mean, for me, even with friends or anyone that I invite over, it's a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're coming back to a space that I have to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
It's different if we met at a coffee shop, we met at a movie, we met at a whatever. Yeah. I don't have to go back there again.
Yeah.
You know? But like bringing someone over to my personal space is like, you know, I will always remember that.
Yeah.
I sold my car recently. Anybody who knows me knows I've had this car for the majority of how long I've been working in film. And yeah. I'd always come in with this Volvo XC90 SUV all the time coming in. I think I drove Marco in it a few times in our studio. Like you know what I mean? Like people know me with that Volvo.
Yeah.
I just sold that Volvo, cleaned it up before I sold it. And I got emotional because I found this straw wrapper.
Yeah.
And I remember it was my, I just had this flood of a memory of my ex-girlfriend. She had the straw wrapper. She's like, oh, where do I put this? I'm like, oh, just leave it in the side. I'll grab it later. I'll throw it out.
Yeah.
I never did.
Years later. Yeah.
Well, I mean, about 3 or 4 months later.
Okay.
But
yeah.
So still, I mean, I just sold it like at the end of August.
Yeah.
But I found this wrapper and it was like, I realized, you know, not only giving away that car, and selling that car sort of just threw all of that out.
Yeah.
And it felt so like cathartic in a way.
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah, man, it's insane. It really is insane to just sit in that.
Well, the car is an interesting thing. I wrote, there's a piece in Greenbelt Summer that's a letter to my car. Because I had a car that I bought when I was like 24 or 25 and I did all these road trips in this car and it was like this, there's so many, so many formative memories in that car.
Wow.
And the car eventually died.
Yeah.
And I wrote this goodbye letter to this car. And like, I've had people say it's the most emotional piece. And they're like, I had the friend who recorded my audiobook while we were recording it.
Yeah.
He was getting teary and like emotional. And he was like, I had a car like that, that like meant that much to me. And he was like, and while you were like going through it, it was like, everything was coming back to me kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, the funny thing is that story in the book about the car is like supposed to be that I'm getting rid of the car. Right.
Yeah.
That car is still on my driveway. I can't do it. I've had a different car for 2 years and it's
wow.
Yeah. It's completely dead. It could be during the pandemic, they were scrapping cars for like 10 grand. Like you could get cash. And my friends were like, you've had this, just get rid of the car, get a bunch of cash. And I can't do it. It's still sitting in my driveway.
But you'll get there.
I think I'll get there. I've been, it's actually during my like COVID stint. Yeah. It was one of the things on the to-do list was like call a wrecker to come get the car.
Yeah.
And I haven't done it, but I think I'm finally getting close, but it's like that. Yeah. I picked up my dog in that car when I adopted my dog. Like the first kiss with my ex was in that car. There's so many things, man. You know, like, so yeah, spaces are an interesting thing. We said we weren't going to talk about breakups and stuff, but apparently that went out the window.
That completely, you know what?
Yeah.
We were going to end this a while ago, Marco. I think we should.
Yeah. And with that.
That's funny. And with that, just enjoy the spaces you're in and take care of the people in them.
Wow. Yeah. That's a really lovely way to wrap that up. Thank you.
Thanks for chatting, Matt. Seriously.
Yeah. This has been really great. Nice.
Thank you.